The scripture readings we follow when we're not doing a special preaching series are from the three-year cycle of readings called the Revised Common Lectionary. Some of you know this already. Over time, the church has experimented with lots of different patterns of readings, and the Revised Common Lectionary was developed in the 60s in the wake of the Catholic Church's Second Vatican Council. One of the cool innovations was to include a reading each week from the Hebrew Bible that helped shed light on the gospel reading. For many centuries, a not-so-subtle anti-Semitism resulted in never reading the Hebrew scriptures in church. While we don't read two texts, let alone four, as the Revised Common Lectionary suggests, we regularly draw on Hebrew Bible stories to help make sense of the gospel, as I will today. Each individual reading that we get in the lectionary is called a pericope, which is a Greek word adopted into English to refer to an extract from a text, especially a passage from the Bible. In Greek, it is made up of two words, kopi, cutting, and peri, around, so cutting around the text, so that you have basically a text that's read out of context. Well, that's usually fine. It's part of the work of preaching to put the text back in context, not only in the book it is from, like Mark's gospel in this case, and in relationship to the Hebrew scriptures that it quotes or implies indirectly, but also the overall arc of the story of the Bible that tells about God's creation and love and redemption of the world. So, like, this is probably an excessively nerdy beginning to the sermon, but I say it partly as a way of making sense of our practice of interpreting scripture with scripture. Looking at a pericope by itself can lead to misunderstanding and, too often, self-serving misunderstandings. The whole phrase taking a scripture or a text out of context is sort of associated with that misappropriation of text. For just an example, the only way that Christian nationalists like Josh Hawley, who we talked about together on Thursday night this past week, the only way he can claim the supremacy of Anglo-American values as grounded in Christian faith, that is the supremacy of Europe, that is the supremacy of whiteness or white people, is by painfully wrenching scripture texts out of context. Our text today has been read as anti-Jewish. Look, Moses and Elijah, representing the law and the prophets, are no longer needed. Jesus replaces them. In fact, this text does the opposite. It's a deeply Jewish take on Jesus, showing how much he was in continuity with the tradition and carried it on. So I want to look at a couple ways this is true in this text and then wonder what it might mean for us and how we live our lives of faith today. The first way this text is drawing on tradition is the obvious symbolism of Moses and Elijah with Jesus on the mountain and God appearing in a cloud. This evokes the heart of Jewish history and especially the story of Mount Sinai with the giving of the Ten Commandments. Their appearance here, Moses and Elijah, is a signal that Jesus is in continuity with tradition and will carry it faithfully forward. Then the second place that Mark draws from is the prophetic book of Daniel. The first half of Daniel are the well-known and actually pretty hilarious stories from the exile in Babylonia under the tyrant king Nebuchadnezzar. We usually read one of those, or often read one of those stories at the Easter Vigil. Think of the story of the three young men thrown into the fire, for example, or Daniel himself being thrown in the lion's den. They are stories of promise that God will save God's people, that God will bring life out of death. The second half of Daniel, however, is quite different. It's a series of visions of geopolitical conflict and powerful divine characters that show God's power. It's more likened to the revelation of John, more apocalyptic literature than the sort of folksy narratives of the first half of the book. And in chapter 10 of Daniel's prophetic book, Daniel has a vision concerning a great conflict, and he fasts. And after a couple of weeks, he has this vision of a person dressed in glowing linen, face like lightning, eyes flaming. And although Daniel is afraid, the person says, "Do not be afraid. You are highly esteemed. Peace be with you." And then the divine person says, "I have come to fight on your behalf." Then, third, and most immediately at the end of the previous chapter in Mark, Peter declares Jesus is the Messiah. And then Jesus, echoing the prophets before him, describes how, as Messiah, he will suffer, be rejected, and killed, and 3 days later will arise. Peter then pulls him aside to rebuke him, presumably not having this sort of suffering servant in mind, but rather some kind of triumphant king Messiah. Then Jesus tells the disciples and the whole gathered crowd what his messiahship actually looks like, using quite paradoxical phrases. He says, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it." So the drama of the mountaintop experience with bright shining clothing and God's presence and blessing refers in part back to this vision in Daniel, and in part is an invitation to us not to misconstrue the way of the cross as the way to what God offers us. So the dramatic mountaintop events consecrate Jesus' way as God's way. And this voice, again, that was spoken at Jesus' baptism confirms this, God calling Jesus beloved and saying, "Listen to him." So if we listen to him, what does he say? He says, "Follow this way of the cross, this way of compassion and transformative love. It's a way that takes sides, that engenders conflict. It takes the side of love." And is suffering entailed necessarily? To some extent it is. Such is human life, limited by mortality, challenged by the actions that harm self, that harm others, that we all do, that all of us suffer. The profundity of the story of the Transfiguration is Jesus, in a sense, saying only in and through the suffering comes healing. The literal meaning of the word salvation. The Latin base of salvation is salvus, which means alive, safe, well. I had a really wonderful conversation at Bible study this past week with Waben, and he remarked how profound the incarnation is for him, that God would enter our suffering and with humility take sides with us in our suffering and seek this salvation, this making alive and safe and well. We ponder what this might mean, all of this, just as Jesus' disciples pondered what they had heard and experienced. That is what it means to be part of a tradition, I think, to be disciples, to be following this radical way and trying to make sense of it as we do. As Waben put it in our conversation, tradition joins us to thousands of years of people grappling with the meaning of Jesus' life and ministry, his rejection and death, and his rising from the dead. They didn't have it all figured out, and we don't either. But just as Jesus was not coming out of the blue, but rather rooted in and furthering a tradition, so we too are invited into this tradition. This faith is a way of life that looks like loss, but is rather gain, that looks like rejection and suffering and death, but is rather salvus, this making alive and safe and well, because God does not desire the suffering and death of any of the creatures, us included. God desires for us to hear the words spoken to Jesus. You are my beloved. I desire for you to be alive and safe and well. We share the sermon here at St. Lydia's and we'll spend a few moments in silence. Then when you hear the sound of the bell, you're invited to share your stories or experiences that were sparked by the text or that are invited in some way by the reflections I've offered. So we'll pause and then share with each other. We begin in silence.